The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
My next guest is an entrepreneur and social impact advocate. Sonia Lennon is with me now for What Made Me. Sonia, you're so welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you with us. So we want to know all about how you got to where you are today and where it all started. But you were always, even from a teeny, teeny tot, interested in fashion and design, weren't you?
Oh yeah, I still have notebooks full of my fashion creations from probably about the age of 10. Horrendous now, absolutely horrendous, but they still
exist.
I'm
sure they were lovely.
Well, they were kind of sexy aliens. So I used to get fizzy watching fashion television and seeing international catwalks, and kind of always felt that was the direction of travel.
And what did the family think of this as an option for you growing up?
My mum was a transatlantic cabin crew for Aer Lingus, so she had very international references, cultural references. So she was, I mean, she loved shopping in New York back in the day.
And glam.
Yeah, so we had a lot of stuff before other people. Like, I was the first kid I knew who had leg warmers. And the halo effect of that to my wider group was kind of amazing. So I got to sense what it felt like to feel good about how you look and how it positively impacts those around you.
So when you said you wanted to work in this area...
Yeah, they said no.
Did they?
Yeah. They were like, oh, well, we don't know if you can make a career at that. Yeah. But I pursued...
Would you look at the civil service,
exactly.
Maybe,
well, it wasn't quite that, but they definitely had dreams of me going to university, because neither of them had. And then circumstances went against me. I applied for fashion in NCAD. I had a couple of insurance policy arts courses on there as well. And I left school, went to Loretto on the Green in 1986. I was my leaving year, and that was the year of the fire that tragically killed six nuns. And a lesser side effect of that was that the art room burnt down and all of our portfolios were gone. So I couldn't apply to art college. So I just said, I kind of thumbed my nose at it, and I said, I'm going to work in luxury fashion retail. And that's what I did.
That's what you did. So where did that take you then? You did that for a while.
Yeah,
and then...
I did that for a few years. I worked with really avant-garde stores like Vivian Walsh's Camouflage, which was on Dawson Street, where... Marco Pierre White's is now, and Firenze, that was at the base of the Westbury Hotel. It was the time when there was a store called O'Tokyo on South Ann Street. It was very, very early doors, international collections, very avant-garde, way ahead of its time, those founders of those stores. But I absolutely loved it. And then I discovered styling, and I thought, wow, this is an opportunity to paint pictures with clothes. And that felt really potent
to
me.
So you became a personal stylist
No,
then?
Not at all. A commercial fashion stylist. So I would work on fashion campaigns or music videos or TV commercials, and travel around the world doing gorgeous work and painting pictures with clothes and coming together like a circus, creating a campaign and then moving on. So I was a freelance fashion stylist.
It
was
fabulous. Sounds like a lovely life.
It was so much fun.
Especially at that stage of your life.
Yeah, and it was Dublin in the 90s, which was pretty much like the funnest thing you could possibly imagine. So like flying on private jets to music festivals with bands and backstage and guerrilla gigs with David Bowie and all that kind of stuff. It was amazing.
Living the dream.
Living the dream.
But then opportunity knocked again, didn't it?
Well, it's funny because I didn't see it in that way at the time. So I was doing that job for 20 years, loving it, made a really good living, had really good clients. And then I'd done a couple of spots on Off the Rails and Head to Toe before that. And they asked me, would I consider presenting the show? And I said, absolutely not. That's a stupid idea. Why would I do that? And they were
very... Why did you say that?
Because I probably felt, this is a terrible thing to say, people are going to tune out, but I kind of felt it was beneath me. I was like working at a really high level, elite, luxury, and I was probably a bit full of myself. And I thought, why on earth would I do makeovers?
And that's a good thing to be full of yourself.
It's, do you know what? It's interesting because I took a risk at that moment. And that, you know, you talk about the things that made me. That was a pivot point where I leaned into risk and courage in a way that I'd never done before. And I kind of, after grappling with it for a few months, I thought, well, what's the worst that can happen? If I hate it, I can walk away. And if I love it, then I'm on a whole new path. And what happened was that I started in RTE in June or July of 2008. And by the time we were on air with the first show in September, the sector that I'd just left had crumbled because of the international global crisis.
Because just before you said the year, I was thinking, which year you weren't probably full time in RTE, so you could have done a bit of both, but it was gone.
It was gone, and I couldn't have done a bit of both. It was full time. Like when we were on and we were shooting, it was full on. You know, and every makeover took 3 weeks, tail to tail. You were living in these people's lives. You were, you know, when I look back on it, we were part psychotherapist, part stylist, you know, and we lived through the evolution of these women. Now, in fairness, they'd done a huge amount of work to get to the point where they were and to be right for the show.
Yes.
But for us to then layer on top of that a sense of permission to say, you can feel good about yourself. That's what they needed.
Mm-hmm. So the other work then, seemed, that was a very wise choice then to take that gig at the time.
Yeah.
But how did it change your life?
Completely. Completely. Because I saw the kind of democratization of what I had been doing. Whereas I'd been working at a very kind of niche elite level. Yeah. I saw then, well, actually, if you give this gift to people, general people, It can change their lives, and it did. Like, we begged for revisit shows because people would fundamentally change their lives after that moment in the mirror. They'd leave no good fiancés, they'd buy camper vans, they'd set up businesses, they'd go travelling. All this great stuff happened because they were empowered. They had empowered themselves and given themselves permission to thrive. So then I thought, well, that's kind of amazing. And I started getting pulled into kind of working to support charities and nonprofits and stuff like that. And it was all a bit haphazard. And I thought, well, actually, I come from privilege. I always say I have a double privilege of not wanting for anything, but also being loved and trusted by the family that created me. And I think that's a solid gold gift that I have an opportunity to kind of leverage and use in a way that can help others. And I read about Dress for Success, which was kind of like grassroots makeovers. It was like, get out into the trenches, see the women who really, really need support, give them the permission, the tools, the clothing, the guidance to get sustainable careers, moving towards economic independence. And then that changes everything. And I was initially attracted to children's charities because I thought they're the most vulnerable in our society. And I read a piece of research, very, very depressing piece of research, which I've been pilloried for before, but I'm going to say it again. The research said antisocial behaviour is directly linked to low self-esteem of the mother. Now, that is pushing the blame on the mother in one way, but it's also saying if you support the mother, you support the whole family dynamic and the community dynamic. And we've seen that play out.
So then, and I'll tell you what at the time, I remember Dress for Success being set up. And what I understood it to be was helping people to get ready for the working world, for the job interview, by giving them the clothes, which gave them the confidence to sit down and answer the questions that were being asked of them. Is that what that was ultimately?
Well, so the clothes is the bit of the iceberg you can see above the waterline. What happens beneath the waterline is the continuous support that we give those clients around mentoring, around career guidance, about positioning their previous experience. So if you can think about it, you know, you've been out of the workforce for 10 years on caring duties, or maybe you've been in a marriage and you've been, engaged in the home and you haven't been employed, and suddenly you're divorced and you have to get back out there. You know, the lack of confidence and the lack of self-belief that women experience needs to be addressed. So it's far more than just the clothes. The clothes can do so much, but it's actually around the ancillary supports that we give the clients.
Okay.
And I should say now, it's no longer a Dress for Success. It's now Work Equal.
Okay. So how did that happen? How did that evolution happen from Dress to Success?
So we always hated the name, no disrespect to Dress for Success, because it felt kind of frivolous. And
well, it feels all about the clothes, doesn't it?
Exactly. And we, that wasn't the message that we wanted to put out there. But also kind of from an administrative point of view, we were bound to Dress for Success Dublin, and we knew we had to serve the whole country. And the terms of our license agreement with New York didn't allow for that. And they couldn't understand how Ireland would need a country agency, because they think in different scale to us, you know. So we broke away from them, called it Work Equal, and also Dress for Success. Men were allergic to it because they felt it was a kind of a woman's thing, whereas now we've had so much more men involved in both funding and service delivery. You know, our board is 50-50, all of that kind of stuff. And so now we get out into the regions, we hit town with a truck full of clothing, a gang of HR volunteers and career guides, guides, and we can serve up to 200 women in a sitting, individually bespoke to their needs.
And last week, Work Equal won a great award, the News Talk Changemakers overall prize, which I'm sure you were very proud to receive.
Well, we won two, actually. We won our category, which was inclusive workplaces, and then nobody was more surprised than us to win the overall award, because our team is tiny. And, you know, I'm not operationally involved. I founded it. I was on the board. There's a team of four that create an infrastructure for we've served almost 10,000 women back into work at this stage since we began, and those numbers are growing year on year. I'm so incredibly happy for the team and proud of what they've achieved.
Okay, so there's that part of you, the social entrepreneur, but then you keep the design side alive as well, don't you?
Well, I do, but how I frame design now in my life has very much changed. So I suppose about 3 years ago, I realised with a bit of an epiphany that I was much more interested in concepts, positive impact and social change than I was in stuff. So where I keep my design alive now is in designing social change and social reform. So I suppose when I look at what has happened through Work Equal, and I look at the evolution of those women that we've served and my own evolution, right? So I'm going to be 58 at the end of this year. I now see that the biggest challenge to workplace equity is the sort of invisible and taboo subject of ageism in the workplace.
Right. Tell me about it. Well, what do you see?
I see that there is a cloak of invisibility that falls over people once they hit kind of 50, maybe mid 50. There are plenty of firms that are pretty blatant about the fact that, you know, you end at 50, your career ends at 50 or 55 in this particular sector. That's just the way it rolls. But actually, we are an aging population. And actually, just to add to that, the research will show you that there is a cliff in terms of investment in training and development, learning and development for people over 50 in the workplace. So there are these kind of floating assumptions that maybe they can't learn more, or maybe they're not worth investing in. So there's a really kind of insidious...
Makes no sense.
Because it makes no sense.
At that age, you have made all of the mistakes. You've learned all of the lessons. You are so experienced, and you should be so valuable to any organisation.
So this
but
is
maybe
the
mission. We're biased coming...
Well, we are biased, right? And that's I call that earned and discerned wisdom. So we know it because we've lived it. But what I've done now is create a framework and a transformational change program for organisations to unlock the value of the experienced worker. We're in an ageing population situation, which is being framed as an iceberg. But if we get ahead of it, it can be our biggest opportunity. So the people in that age cohort, most of them want to work. They want to work.
Sonia, we will have to continue this conversation, I feel, because there's a whole other section that we need to get to. Thank you so much for coming in. That is Sonia Lennon. We have to go. My thanks to you for listening. Don't forget, if you missed anything, you can listen back on the Go Loud app. The team, Cormac McDonagh on sound, producers Dee King, Helena O'Toole and Alex Russo. Research by David O'Connor and Shanna Cole. Our broadcast assistant is Anne-Marie Kane.
The Claire Byrne Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.